A1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Brian Lin tells us how air quality measurement devices can collect DNA. John Russell presents a new everyday grammar lesson. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Brian Lin.
A new study has found that devices used to measure air quality in the environment also take in DNA material from the local area. Scientists say this collected DNA can be useful in identifying what plants and animals have been in the area. It could also help document changes in the environment over time. Researchers say the finding suggests air quality measuring devices have collected large amounts of biodiversity data. But the collection efforts have not been recognized until now, said Elizabeth Clare. She is a biologist at Canada's York University and a lead writer of the study. As animals and plants go through their life cycles, they leave small pieces of themselves in the environment. This includes materials such as fur, feathers, or pollen that identify their genetic makeup. Scientists have long known this kind of environmental DNA can float in water. They have even used it to follow or track different species in lakes and rivers. But it has been much harder to get a genetic picture of animals living on land, said Christine Bowman. She studies environmental DNA at the University of Copenhagen. She was not involved in the latest study. In 2021, both Bowman and Clare worked on similar projects to see whether they could pull animal DNA from the air. After setting up collection equipment in local zoos, the teams were able to capture and examine DNA from many different species. After seeing success in that process, the researchers wanted to expand their efforts to larger areas. In the latest study, Claire and her team tested air filters from two measuring stations, one in London and one in Scotland. The two places are part of a large network that tests for pollution. After getting DNA from pieces inside the air filters, the team was able to identify more than 180 different kinds of plants and animals, study writer Joanne Littlefair said. She is a biologist at Queen Mary University of London. The filter data identified many different life forms, including grasses, fungi, deer, hedgehogs, and songbirds, Littlefair said. Now the team hopes to capture DNA data on ecosystems all over the world. Claire noted that even though biodiversity issues affect the whole world, it is hard to carry out widespread testing. James Allerton is an air quality scientist at Britain's National Physical Laboratory. He told the Associated Press that it is much easier to use capturing systems that are already in place. Allerton noted that many countries have networks to measure air quality. Some also store their old filters for many years. He said such data could help demonstrate how ecosystems have changed over time. Fabian Roger is working on a similar project at ETH Zurich in Switzerland. He wrote in an email to the AP that more research will be needed to see if data from the filters can show real biodiversity changes over time. Roger added that he finds it exciting that an existing system could help track wildlife across large areas in the environment. I'm Brian Lynn.
Imagine you are shopping at a market. Perhaps you are in a situation in which you need to negotiate a price. How do you do so? In today's Everyday Grammar, we will explore a point of connection between grammar and the economy. You will learn about some of the terms and structures we use to reach agreement on prices. In an earlier Everyday Grammar, we explored questions about prices. We discussed the term how much and explained why it is central to talking about prices. When we negotiate prices, we have a few more important elements. Of special importance are the words this or that and their related plural forms, these and those. In some cases, we use this or that as pronouns, meaning they take the place of nouns. We use this if the item or object is close to you. We use that if the item or object is at a distance or farther away. These is the plural form of this. Those is the plural form of that. When you use this and that as pronouns, you might also need to point with your finger. The reason we point is because this and that can be unclear to the listener. But when you point with a finger or pick up an object, the listener will understand what you are talking about. The advantage of using this and that is that it allows you to ask about an object even if you do not know the name for it. As a result, you might feel more confident in your speaking. Let's explore an example. Imagine you are at a market and you pick up an object. A discussion might go like this.
How much is this?
$20. Our question involves how much, the verb be, and this, a pronoun. So, we have our basic ingredients. How might a further discussion about price go?
How much is this?
$20.
Would you take 15?
I would take 17 for it.
Okay, that works.
Notice that our buyer asked the question, would you take 15? This question involves the modal would along with the main verb take. The speaker used 15 in place of $15. Notice that the seller uses the modal would in the response. I would take 17 for it. So, we have the modal would and the main verb take playing important parts in our price discussions. But there are other ways that price discussions take place. We could propose a different price in a negotiation by using the phrase, "How about?" Let's listen to how this might sound.
How much is this?
$20.
Would you take 15?
How about 17?
Okay, sounds good.
How about 17 is called a fragment because it is not a complete sentence. The fragment, how about 17, suggests something like the following language. How about you pay me $17? But instead of using a full sentence, speakers often used a shortened version. This is how we arrive at, how about 17? Let's take some time to work with these ideas. Ask about the price of a pair of shoes that are near to you. Pause the audio to consider your answer. Here is one possible answer.
How much are these?
The reason we used these is because we are talking about a pair of shoes, not one shoe. As a result, we use a plural form of the verb be as well. Now imagine that the discussion continues.
How much are these?
$10. How might you negotiate a lower price? Pause the audio to consider your answer. Here are a couple possible answers. You might say,
would you take 8?
Or,
how about 8?
There are, of course, other ways to ask about lowering the price, but would you take and how about are two nice possibilities. Today we explored a few ways to negotiate a price. There are, of course, many other ways to do so. In future lessons, we will explore negotiations in greater detail, as well as many other fun, useful grammar issues that connect with everyday life. I'm John Russell.
Just heard this week's Everyday Grammar lesson with John Russell. John joins us now to talk a little bit more about it. Welcome, John.
Hi, Ashley. Thanks for having me on the show.
You presented some useful information about negotiating prices. What are some other pieces of information that you were not able to include in the lesson?
I didn't include anything about the connection between culture and negotiations. One important thing for our listeners to know about the United States in particular is that price negotiations are less common than they are in many other countries.
Yes, that is true. Americans sometimes negotiate in used or second-hand markets, such as flea markets, garage sales, or on websites like Facebook Marketplace. We also sometimes negotiate prices for big purchases, cars or houses.
But overall, I would say that the average American probably negotiates much less often than the average person in many other countries.
Well, thank you for talking to us about those cultural differences, John. It's always good to be aware of them.
Thank you for having me on the show. See you next time.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of America's 42nd president, Bill Clinton. He was a popular and successful president who was re-elected in 1996. But he also became only the second president in American history ever to be put on trial in Congress. Clinton's past in Arkansas became the source of accusations and questions about his character as he was running for president. These included questions about financial dealings with a land development company called Whitewater. In January of 1994, President Clinton asked Attorney General Janet Reno to appoint an independent lawyer to lead an investigation. She named a Republican, but some critics said her choice was too friendly to the Clinton administration. He was replaced by another Republican, Kenneth Starr. In 1995, the Senate Judiciary Committee began its own investigation of the president. The committee later reported that it had not found evidence of any crimes. However, because the committee was led by Democrats, there was continuing suspicion of the president among Republicans. The main cause of that suspicion dated back to a purchase of land in Arkansas years earlier. Bill and Hillary Clinton had bought the land in 1978, the year he was first elected governor of that state. The Clintons formed the Whitewater Development Company with Susan and James McDougall. The goal was to sell vacation homes along a river. However, the company did poorly. James McDougall also owned Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan, for which Hillary Clinton did legal work. Madison failed during the 1980s. The McDougalls were found guilty of wrongdoing in connection with that failure. A former local judge in Little Rock, the state capital, also became part of the story. In 1994, David Hale pleaded guilty to charges of cheating the federal government. That case was in connection with a lending company he owned and was not connected to Whitewater. But Hale accused Bill Clinton of having pressured him while governor to loan money to Susan McDougall and other politically influential people. Clinton denied the accusations. During the president's first term, investigators sought billing records for Hillary Clinton's past legal work for James McDougall. They wanted to know, in connection with the Whitewater investigation, how much time she had spent on that work. The First Lady said she could not find the records. Then, in January of 1996, the billing records appeared without explanation in the White House. That mystery only added to the suspicions of some Americans. Others thought Kenneth Starr was just wasting taxpayer money on his investigation of the Clintons. They felt it was just for political reasons. The Whitewater investigation became increasingly complex and difficult to follow. In the end, President Clinton was never charged with any wrongdoing in connection with his financial dealings. But his legal problems did not stop there. In 1994, a former Arkansas state employee named Paula Jones sued President Clinton. She brought a civil action accusing him of sexual harassment while governor of Arkansas. In her lawsuit, she said he had asked her for sex. A federal judge dismissed her case for lack of evidence. Paula Jones appealed that ruling. Her lawyers said they wanted to prove that Clinton had a pattern of such behavior with female employees, including while president. They suspected that these included a 21-year-old woman named Monica Lewinsky. Lewinsky had worked as an unpaid intern in the White House. Kenneth Starr was still investigating the Whitewater case early in 1998. He received permission to include Lewinsky in his investigation.
Hi, how'd you know it was me?
I have caller ID.
Oh, what's it say?
Linda Tripp.
A former friend of Monica Lewinsky, Linda Tripp, had given Starr tape recordings of her telephone conversations with the younger woman.
I hate him. No, you don't. You hate his behavior at times.
In the recordings, Lewinsky talked about her relationship with the president. What she told Linda Tripp conflicted with the information she gave to lawyers for Paula Jones. She had told them that the relationship had not been sexual. Lawyers for Paula Jones also questioned President Clinton. He, too, denied that the relationship with Monica Lewinsky had been sexual. On January 26, 1998, the president stated his denial to the American public.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie. Not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people.
Later in the year, the president agreed to answer questions before a federal grand jury.
The opening statement I made is that I had inappropriate intimate contact. I take full responsibility for it. It wasn't her fault, it was mine. I do not believe that I violated the definition of sexual relations I was given by directly touching those parts of her body with the intent to arouse or gratify. And that's all I have to say.
This was the first time an investigating jury had ever called a president to testify while in office.
This afternoon in this room, from this chair, I testified before the Office of Independent Counsel and the grand jury. I answered their questions truthfully, including questions about my private life, questions no American citizen would ever want to answer. Still, I must take complete responsibility for all my actions, both public and private. And that is why I am speaking to you tonight.
After his appearance, the president went on national television and admitted the nature of his relationship with Monica Lewinsky.
As you know, in a deposition in January, I was asked questions about my relationship with Monica Lewinsky. While my answers were legally accurate, I did not volunteer information. Indeed, I did have a relationship with Ms. Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong.
He said his actions were a personal failure, but he denied trying to get her to lie about the relationship.
But I told the grand jury today, and I say to you now, that at no time did I ask anyone to lie, to hide or destroy evidence, or to take any other unlawful action. I know that my public comments and my silence about this matter gave a false impression. I misled people, including even my wife. I deeply regret that.
Kenneth Starr sent his final report to the House of Representatives. The report suggested that President Clinton may have committed impeachable crimes in trying to hide his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. In the United States, to impeach a president means to bring charges in the House of Representatives. The charges result in removal from office if the president is found guilty in a trial in the Senate. The Chief Justice of the United States serves as the judge, and the senators serve as the jury. In December of 1998, the House of Representatives voted to impeach President Clinton. The House sent the charges to the Senate to hold a trial. The two articles of impeachment accused him of lying to a federal grand jury and obstructing justice. Only one other president had ever been impeached. In 1868, the House of Representatives brought charges against Andrew Johnson. The case related to his removal of a cabinet member. The Senate held a trial, but Andrew Johnson's presidency survived by one vote. The threat of impeachment led President Richard Nixon to resign in 1974 over his cover-up of political wrongdoing in the Watergate case.
It is up to the members of the House of Representatives to vote their conscience on the Constitution and the law, which I believe are clear, and I have no intention of resigning. It's never crossed my mind.
Bill Clinton still had 2 years left as president. In public opinion surveys, two-thirds of the people said they opposed removing him from office.
What I want the American people to know, what I want the Congress to know, is that I am profoundly sorry for all I have done wrong in words and deeds. I never should have misled the country, the Congress, my friends, or my family. Quite simply, I gave in to my shame. I have been condemned by my accusers with harsh words. And while it's hard to hear yourself called deceitful and manipulative, I remember Ben Franklin's admonition that our critics are our friends, for they do show us our faults.
The Senate decided President Clinton's future in February of 1999. The 100 senators held a trial to consider the charges and decide if he should be removed from office. Each charge required 67 votes to find him guilty. 10 members of the Republican majority joined Democrats in voting to clear Clinton of the perjury charge. The Senate was evenly divided on the charge of interfering with justice, thus no guilty verdict. Bill Clinton remained president of the United States. As a historical footnote, as it turned out, Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich was himself cheating on his wife while leading the impeachment action against President Clinton. The difference, Gingrich would say years later, was that Clinton was charged with lying after he legally swore to tell the truth. In October 1999, Kenneth Starr resigned as the independent counsel. An assistant, Robert Ray, completed a final report on the Whitewater investigation. He issued his report in September 2000. The report said there was not enough evidence to prove any wrongdoing by Bill or Hillary Clinton.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.